Be seated. This is our next case for the day. Cheyenne Soto Alicio versus Kevin Allen Ferguson. And we have Mr. James here for the appellant. And also with you, Ms. Setters. Oh, I'm sorry. Wrong side here. So, Ms. Schultz. With you. Okay, thank you. It's nice to bring in everybody you can to help you and get this experience from being here also. And then on this side, Ms. Santana and Ms. Setters. All right, this case is here through the pro bono program. So thank you, Ms. Santana, for taking this on. It always helps our court to have people like you that are willing to do it. And do a nice job with it, too. And, of course, Mr. James, we see you frequently on family law cases. You always do a great job, too. Nice to have you back. Of course, I'm joined today by Judge Bonnie Bullitt to my left and Judge Deborah Westbrook to my right. And I'm Judge Michael Gibbons. Right. So any requests for rebuttal time?
4 minutes.
4 minutes. Right. You weren't in here for the last case. Counsel requested 5 minutes and only had a minute left because we asked a bunch of questions right at the 5 minute mark. So I added 2 minutes. We'll try to avoid that problem, though. All right. You may proceed.
Chief Judge Gibbons, Judge Bulla, Judge Westbrook, may it please the court, Peter James, bar number 10091 for the appellant, Cheyenne Soto Alessio. What we have here is a child custody case over, at the time of trial, a then two and a half year old child named Elias. Now, Dad, to give him credit, was honest for the most part at trial. He didn't lie, but what he did do was evade questions. They were asked very specifically over some very specific issues on domestic violence. A certain thing was alleged, domestic violence, battery, pushing up against a wall, throwing out of a car with no shirt on. His responses were things like, well, my lawyers handled that. But that was already handled in court before. My lawyers established my innocence before. Those charges were dropped. That's not an answer. This goes back to law school for me. I remember with Professor Wansiewicz at Boyd Law School, where we went over in evidence class what an adoptive admission or an admission by silence is. When you're asked a question, and any reasonable person would immediately deny it if they didn't do it, and the fact that you don't deny this is really an admission. Now, there in the Puritan case, there's actually Nevada law that said a non-specific evasive answer is not an answer and cannot provide substantial evidence. And that's what we have here in this case. Dad kept avoiding the issue. Now, I like the way that...
I know, Mr. James, it looks like that, but remember, we're at the appellate level and we're not there determining the witness's demeanor and if he's doing the things you're describing. Yes, the record shows what it shows. How far can we go on that when we're not really in the business of evaluating the credibility of somebody?
Well, it doesn't really go to credibility. It goes to the answer and the non-answer, because he never actually answered the question. If I were to ask you, sir, did you just beat up your wife? Oh, well, the police never arrested me for that. Okay, that's not an answer. When you're asked a direct question, you give a direct answer. Now, he could have very simply said, that never happened. But he didn't. He chose to say, my lawyers handled. He's evading. He's dodging the question and not answering it. That's not a credibility issue. That's a non-answer issue. Now, he said it in such a way that the court said, well, I believed him when he said he didn't do it. And we're trying to say, well, the court shouldn't have believed him when he said he didn't do it. That would be credibility. This is not. This is a non-answer.
What do you suggest we do with that type of answer?
Deem them admissions. Very straightforward. All he had to do was simply say it didn't happen. Another thing that I remember that he said here, mom said that the child was in the room and saw it as well. Well, the child never saw anything like that. Hang on. Didn't he just say, I didn't do that? But he's phrasing it in such a way that he's dodging the question. And that's a very big issue. And I give Dad props for not lying. He did everything he could do to get around it and not admit it without lying. And he did a good job tap dancing, better than many attorneys do in trying to spin law.
Maybe that helps prove one of the other points in this case, and that is about all the exhibits that were not admitted, that maybe he thought they were going to be admitted and he had to dance around them.
Well, what he thought, we don't know. That would be pure speculation. But they weren't admitted, and quite frankly, they should have been. They did establish that these things did happen and that statements were made at the time, which he didn't object as to hearsay. The main issue that the judge had, the trial court judge, was she said, well, these weren't disclosed or provided in time. And the judge had the timeline wrong. She provided them on May 1. Trial was on May 23, I believe, of that year. And it was more than 21 days, but her exhibits had previously also been filed with the court as exhibits to motions. So under Rule 16205, they're deemed disclosed. Now, she just provided them 21 days before.
Under which rule?
16205.
That's
the... Oh, excuse me. No, it's an EDCR. Sorry, it is an EDCR, where if we have filed them in the case, they're deemed disclosed and we can use them at trial. So, but the court had the timeline wrong. The court said that they were not timely provided. They weren't, provided to him, and he never received them. But he didn't receive them because he changed his address and didn't tell mom.
But I thought the certificate of mailing showed that they were mailed May 21st, not May 1st. And there is a dispute on that because... the appellant did testify below that she mailed them on May 1st. But independent of that, were all the exhibits she wanted into evidence in through other motion work during the discovery period?
I believe so. I was not trial counsel. They were self-represented at trial. But I believe so. Now, the problem we have here is that the clerk of the court only saved the admitted exhibits, not the ones that were requested to be admitted but denied. So we don't have the record because the clerk destroyed the evidence, which I think that needs to be remedied, that if it's at issue, it needs to be saved until we know if an appeal is filed or not.
Did the district court specifically mention any rule that the appellant violated in order to exclude the exhibits? Was there any analysis regarding that?
I believe there was an untimeliness argument by the court, and if I remember correctly, hearsay. But the dad did not raise the issue himself. And the burden actually is on the party wanting the evidence not admitted to raise the proper objection.
Well, Dad raised two objections. He raised timeliness and authentication objections, specifically, I think, to the emails. And the authentication issue is not before us on appeal.
They were deemed authentic because he didn't object to them prior.
So the lower court deemed them authentic?
No. By rule, they were authentic. If you don't object to them within 21 days after they were provided to you, they're automatically deemed authentic.
But don't they have to be disclosed pursuant to NRCP 16.205 for that to occur?
They were actually provided in motion as exhibits.
But they were not disclosed pursuant to the rule, were they?
They were not disclosed, but the rule says we can use them at trial. So I understand the distinction the court's trying to make here, that the rule that says that we can use them at trial if they are filed as exhibits is not the same as Rule 16205, which triggers the authentication timeline, the 21 days. But the fact that they're deemed disclosed at that point, by analogy, would bring in the 21-day period.
So is it your position that the district court excluded those exhibits as some sort of sanction?
No.
Okay.
In my opinion, the court just deemed them that they were untimely and that they were hearsay. I believe the court erred in doing that. They were highly probative. And as we cited in the brief, there is a Nevada statute that provides, it's 125, I believe, 090, that says the rules of civil procedure apply so far as the ends of justice are served. And given this is a child custody matter, and specifically we were talking about domestic violence, which has a higher priority under Nevada law. We have case law that makes this the subject of exclusion from serial motions under Castle v. Simmons. It has a heightened policy in terming child custody. So this is a highly important issue in the state of Nevada as to domestic violence. And under Castle, all domestic violence is presumed to be negatively impact the best interest of children. So given that, it should have been admitted. Now, what weight the court would have given to it, that would be up to the court. But this is an admission issue, not a weight issue. She excluded the evidence completely. And I think that was error, especially given the tie-in to Dad not denying any of the allegations.
So what about the court's use of the presumption instead of just looking at the best interest factor related to domestic violence? I mean, the court kept saying it's not proven by clear and convincing evidence.
That is correct. There's two different standards for domestic violence. One, preponderance of the evidence to be used as a factor as compared as, you know, equal to any other, where it doesn't give you a presumption. Having another sibling, co-parenting issues, all those things are factors under 120 FXC 003 5764.
So how did the court mess that up? I mean, it's the same statute. But you have subsection 4 with the A through J or whatever that is, and then subsection 5. I mean, they're two different things. It's pretty obvious.
And courts make this error all the time. Courts make the error and said, well, I'm not completely convinced by your evidence. And I'm like, Your Honor, you don't have to be completely convinced. All I have to do is it's more likely than not. And I'm reminding judges all the time at trials, they don't have to be completely convinced. It's preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not.
So possibly the court's credibility findings could save it on this point. I mean, what did the court say about the testimony of your client on this domestic violence issue, about it being believable or not?
Yeah. I understand where the court's going with this. But when you couple this with the fact that Dad never denied it, okay, if he never denied it, Mom says it, now the court doesn't believe Mom and then can't, I mean, what is she going to believe Dad, and Dad didn't answer the question? I mean, this is one of those things where it's really not a credibility issue, because it comes down to what he said.
Did the judge ever just flat out and say, every allegation of domestic violence you've made is not proven by clear and convincing evidence? In fact, you have no credibility, so I'm not going to consider any of it. Or is it more of the latter? It's not proven by clear and convincing evidence.
I would say it's the latter is what happens. She didn't establish it by clear and convincing evidence, which she didn't have to do. But then again, the evidence that was provided was Dad's testimony, Mom's testimony, and Dad's testimony.
Let's say some of her exhibits had been admitted. How would that have affected her credibility or the believability of the domestic violence in particular?
Well, the exhibits would have shown, at least as far as to like the police reports, that it happened, that there was diverse statements made. And the fact that you're saying the same thing continuously at the time it happened and time through, that could have changed the trial court's opinion as well.
How about the photographs?
Yeah.
I mean, if she said she was injured in one of the incidents and she has photographs, seems like rather important evidence.
Yes, it is, and the judge excluded it. And I'm like befuddled by some of the things the district court judges are doing. When it comes to evidence, I actually had a very similar issue to this one raised, where Dad said he had an objection to Mom living with her boyfriend if she's allowed to relocate. And the judge says, what's your issue? And dad said mom's boyfriend put mom into child prostitution when she was 13, and you're going to move our 10-year-old daughter in with this man. And mom's response was, dad's just trying to make my boyfriend look like some kind of monster. Again, a non-answer. Did not say that never happened.
Wasn't that case in front of us?
Yes, it was. And
let me just ask this question, because you're running out of time and I want to respect your desire to have some rebuttal time. What do you envision this court doing? If this court were to reverse and remand, what would you envision? A new trial?
No, deeming his non-answers as admissions as to what happened.
Okay, but what if that can't happen? What if legally that can't happen? What do you envision for a resolution?
At least reverse and remand for a new trial, at a minimum. But I think dad's testimony on the record is pretty clear that he was not going to answer the questions. He evaded the questions.
All right. We'll reserve the rest of your time for rebuttal and add it another minute and 10 seconds. So you have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Based upon the extra questions from the judges.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Hey, welcome, and thank you again for being here through the pro bono program.
Of course. May it please the court, good afternoon, justices. My name is Yadira Santana, and I represent the respondent in this matter. So here we have a trial that was conducted by two pro se litigants. The court very thoroughly asked the litigants the facts and the questions in this case. Both litigants had ample amount of time to testify. The court asked questions, clarification, and specific question as to the best interest factors. I think it's important to note that this trial actually started at 1:36 and concluded at 4:41. So the parties really had extensive testimony. Following that testimony, the court made and filed a findings of fact and conclusion of law that has very specific findings as to the best interest factors. And the standard of review in this matter is abuse of discretion. And the way that the court will findings will be upheld is if they're not clearly erroneous and if they are supported by evidence. Here it's very clear that the findings and the factors stated in the decree are very much supported by the party's testimony. Now,
don't you also have to have a correct legal analysis, a correct statement of the law? And this district court below chose to use clear and convincing as the standard to view whether or not domestic violence had occurred. But as a best interest factor, that should be preponderance. Do you believe that makes a difference here?
Yes and no, Your Honor. In the decree, the court was very clear when it came to domestic violence. The court very specifically stated that they didn't find clear and convincing evidence to have the presumption of against joint physical custody apply. But then the court actually also acknowledged the parties' testimonies as to domestic violence. So the decree very much acknowledged mom's testimony that there was an incident, domestic violence, and there was an arrest. And the court very also acknowledged that she stated that she decided not to go with any charges. So I do think that the court did consider all the factors and still didn't find that there was enough.
Right. But under subsection finding? K, though, it says this factor was not applicable as there was no clear and convincing evidence that domestic violence has occurred. So the court actually did apply the clear and convincing standard to the factor under subsection K, when it should have been a preponderance of the evidence, correct?
Correct, but the court applied the clear and convincing to specifically state that the presumption against joint physical custody would not apply.
But that was in the analysis of the best interest factors.
She's reading from the order there where it's going through that
page 650
factor.
Yes, and I understand, and my argument would be that, granted again, that the court did acknowledge the clear and convincing and that wasn't the what they found, but also if we're taking the preponderance of the evidence, the court still acknowledged the factors in the testimony, and the court still didn't find anything.
But didn't the... Okay, sorry, go ahead.
So what did the court do with it then? I mean, you heard Mr. James's argument, and it's pretty well established in Nevada. If there's domestic violence, the court has to consider it. Because it's not good to have children around an abuser.
No, and absolutely. And I think that goes as to the arguments as denial. I think that there is a denial in this matter. The client specifically stated that he was able to prove his innocence. Maybe this is not the perfect denial, but there's absolutely no type of case law or statute in Nevada in family court cases that say that absence of denial or perfect denial by any means admissions by silence. So when it comes to the allegations, the client very much did deny the allegations. I would like to quote in Bates Stance 509, the client stated, I have had false allegations, but I've been able to prove my innocence in everything. That is a denial.
But counsel, a conviction is not necessary to find that domestic violence occurred, is it?
No, it is not. But he did state he was able to prove my innocence in everything. He very clearly stated that the allegations were false, not necessarily in the criminal context, but in general.
Should the court still have considered the TPOs?
So with regards to the TPOs, the parties didn't really testify as to the extent of the details during the evidentiary trial. It should be noted that during mom's closing arguments, that's when she brought in a lot of different facts and statements that obviously, because it was closing arguments, the respondent didn't have time to adequately respond to those allegations. But during the time when the parties were discussing the allegations, the clients very specifically stated those allegations were false. They didn't specifically go into detail as to the TPO. I think the respondent even testified that he didn't appear to the TPO extension hearing, and so that may be why it was granted. But there was no facts with regards to specifically the details of why that was granted and the facts around that.
Should the court have considered the TPOs under Nevada law?
I think it depends on the facts that the TPOs were granted. I think had the facts been extremely established in this case and mom actually testified, then maybe at that point it's also credibility. I think it's important to know that the district court in this case also questioned mom's credibility on certain things. And so I think that has a factor as well.
But I mean, if the court's not going to consider the criminal matters, which have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, the highest standard, and then clear and convincing on the presumption, but then on the TPOs, we're just back to the regular standard of preponderance of the evidence. So shouldn't those have been considered?
Again, it would be more of a, if the parties had testified truly as to what that hearing was about, what was stated in that hearing, what the circumstances of that TPO being granted, I think it does warrant a consideration. But here in the record, the parties merely just mentioned the TPO. They didn't really go through it. And the respondent even stated that at that point, he didn't obtain an attorney. He didn't show up to the TPO extension. So essentially, it's almost like the TPO got extended by default. He didn't get to present his state of the facts. So because he didn't have the opportunity, well, he didn't show up, so he didn't give his side of the facts. I think it's a one-sided argument as to the TPO.
But the initial TPO he was present at?
I don't believe so. I believe the initial TPO was just granted on a temporary short basis while the extension hearing was then set. And I believe that's the one he didn't show up to. And so with regards to the trial exhibits, this is where mom's credibility also came in place, because there was an argument as to when she sent the proposed trial exhibits and why she didn't send it to dad's current location, well, new address. In the trial, it's really important to note that at the beginning of trial, she stated that she sent it to dad's old address because she didn't know dad's new address. But later on, she then testified that she didn't get dad's new address until she physically went to court and got the notice of change of address. And then she went on to say that the first thing she did when she arrived to Las Vegas was to go to dad's new address. So her credibility as to dad's address and the taking of the proposed exhibits is questionable in this matter. I would also like to note that while the client may have not specifically objected to hearsay, the district court does have broad discretion on running their court when it comes to making sure that there is efficiency and fairness in courts, especially when you have two pro se litigants. So I believe that the district court acted within its discretion and omitted those.
Isn't there a difference in the quality of the evidence that's offered? For example, police reports. Yes, there's going to be hearsay in there. But what about photographs of injuries?
Well,
those lie.
Well, Your Honor, at that point, the parties talked extensively about the proposed exhibits. Mom testified extensively as to what was in the exhibit. So regardless, the court was able to hear Mom's side of the story, Mom's testimony. And so I don't know how much of a difference the admission of photographs may have been.
The court just said, oh, wasn't timely disclosed, none of it comes in, and didn't take into fact that some of it related to domestic violence, some of it might have been hearsay, some of it wasn't. It was just a blanket ruling. Is that what the procedure is in family court?
Well, you obviously have the best interest factors, right? But you also need to ensure a fair trial. My client testified that he didn't have any chance to look at the exhibits at the time of trial, so he didn't know what those photos were.
Granted, continue it. You take a break. I mean, how long does it take to look at photographs?
Well, that's a great point. But at the same time, you know, the pro se litigants are absolutely still bound by the rules of procedure in order to ensure
some consideration given for people that are pro se, particularly when the safety of children is at issue.
I do believe so, but I also think that in this case, both parties had ample amount of time to actually prepare for trial. The trial was actually continued multiple times at Mom's request. Mom even stated that she even took a self-help class in order to prep. So when we're looking at the issues, I do think that procedurally the court did not make an error. Now, had the court made an error, I do think it would have been a harmless error, as the parties testified.
We'll come back to that. What about the timeline, though, that Mr. James gave? He contends that it was May 1st that the exhibits were presented and the trial was May 23rd, so there was more than 21 days. You know, Judge Bullitt pointed out there's some dispute in the record about that because the document says something else. I mean, what's your take on it?
Well, I do agree that there's a discrepancy as to when these actually were sent. But then again, they were sent to an old address, so the client never had a chance to actually review it. And then that comes into place whether Mom actually knew where Dad resided, because there was discrepancies into her testimony with regards to whether she knew and when she knew Dad's new address. So regardless, the client did testify that he did not have a chance and opportunity to even see these documents and didn't receive them.
So when did he see them for the first time then?
I believe he testified that he saw them that day or the day before.
But that can't be completely accurate, because many of those documents were attached to prior motion work that took place prior to the close of discovery. So he had to have seen those documents before, unless there's something that we're missing here.
So, and that is correct. We don't know exactly what exhibits were proposed, what were sent prior to the close of exhibits and which ones weren't. I also like to know that at that time, parties had a counsel. And so I don't know the extent that he received a full package of the file once his counsel withdrew. I'm not exactly sure. And I'm not exactly sure exactly what he reviewed and what he didn't review.
But he was aware of the TPO. At a minimum.
I do believe so, yes.
Once a document is submitted to counsel, isn't that deemed to have been received by the client?
Yes, but at the same time, I don't know the extent that he had access to these documents while preparing for trial. I do believe that at the time that he was at trial, it had been months since his attorney withdrew. And then just really quickly, with regards to the custody, the factors, the court was very specific with regards to the findings of the best interest factors. I think in this case, the record speaks for itself. And the decree of custody was very clear as to the best interest factors. And the court was very clear as to which factors the court found neutral, which factors the court found to favor Dad, and which factors the court deemed to favor Mom. And while the court does have the broad discretion on how to weigh each factor, I do believe that the court weighed all the factors in this matter adequately.
Well, the court didn't weigh the domestic violence factor under the best interest findings, because the court looked at it as for clear and convincing evidence. So the court did not weigh domestic violence under best interest.
Well, and I understand your argument. And with that, I would also like to note that The court even acknowledged that with mom, there was a domestic violence issue with mom and maternal grandmother, and that there was an arrest, and that even after that domestic dispute between mom and maternal grandmother, mom decided to stay in there in that household with the child. And so the court, even in the record, stated concerns of domestic violence on both sides. And in the record, the respondent even stated that there was an incident where he was actually self-defending because mom was hitting him. So then we're looking at who's the first aggressor, who's the second aggressor. I think that the court, it equaled out essentially, because both parties are now testifying to each being aggressors essentially.
So I have a question in terms of the remedy. Assuming we find an error in terms of the court's improper application of the clear and convincing standard when applying the or when analyzing the best interest factors, and if we were to find error in terms of the court excluding evidence, would the remedy on remand be a whole entire new trial, or would the remedy be to allow the district court to consider the proper evidence along with the evidence already taken?
I think it would be the latter, that the court should just re-look at the trial and see what was already placed on the record, and then apply the preponderance of the evidence factor of domestic violence, and then just review the decree in that.
What if other exhibits are that were excluded are suddenly now available?
Well, again, when it comes to the exhibits in this matter, the police statements, regardless, are hearsay. I'm not exactly sure if mom can, you know, bring police officers or a witness to have those admitted. With regard to the text messages, both parties extensively testified as to the exhibits, and the court heard that testimony.
Just on a side issue, this is a young child. So what happens when the child starts school? Is it appropriate to make the decision now, or when the court did, for something that's going to happen years in the future?
I think it was appropriate to do it now because it was a relocation matter, and the court allowed both parties to share joint physical custody as long as it was appropriate to do so, because once the child is in kindergarten, obviously we can't split the child. And so I do think it was appropriate to make that order now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, even with the extra minute, you have a lot to cover.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to the last question the court asked, as to the premature granting of primary physical custody to dad several years in the future, I would assert that that was improper. If the court had said something to the effect of, well, unless we bring it back on a change in circumstances, this is going to happen, or when the child becomes school age, come back to me and we will then determine what's going to happen. But instead, for years in the future, the court said we're going to have a change, but there's no evidence to change anything yet. It's extremely premature.
But your client's asking for primary custody, correct? So if that was awarded, then she would already, that there wouldn't be an issue because it wouldn't be joint custody.
Correct. And as far as the address issue goes with the exhibits, his objection is essentially moot, any objection he might have, because he changed his address and never told anyone. And that is not in dispute, that he did change it. So when my client mailed it on May 1st, whatever address he had, he wasn't going to get them anyway. So how can he object and say he didn't have them when he wouldn't have gotten them anyway?
Well, just briefly, respondent is saying that your client knew that he lived in a different address, and she mailed it to the old address, if I understood correctly. Is that correct?
I don't recall that, but if she did find out, she found out much later in time that he had moved. At the time she mailed it, she did not know. And that was his address, and that's where she mailed it. So be that as it may, but I do want to highlight with the court that DV is important. It's a very, very big issue in Nevada. We can break leases because of it. We can do all sorts of things.
Would this case have been any different had counsel been there at the trial?
Oh, if I were counsel at this trial, this would definitely have been different.
So is the alleged error here of using the wrong standard for the domestic violence, standing alone, is that enough to reverse?
Yes. A judge is charged with applying the correct legal standard, even if it's not presented, and even in default, a judge is required to apply the correct legal standard.
Because you know, you've seen it many times, there are a lot of best interest factors, and it's tough to say if the court got one wrong, then the whole conclusion is wrong. Is it different with domestic violence?
I believe it would be on this one, definitely, because the court applied the wrong standard. Okay, that's an automatic reversal. If you apply a joint custody relocation standard to a primary custody relocation, it's a per se violation and an automatic reversal. She applied the wrong standard of evidence to this. It should be an automatic reversal and remand back for trial.
And any of the arguments that Ms. Santana made, that the district court actually did consider domestic violence, it just wasn't explicit in its findings. Does that explain this away?
No, because the only explanation the court gave is in its findings of fact, and it doesn't say they applied the wrong, she applied the wrong legal standard. She applied clear and convincing to it, not preponderance.
All right. Thank you, Mr. James, very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. We will take